The Gary Knoll Show, daily at noon on the Progressive Radio Network.
Live from New York City, it's The Gary Knoll Show. And now, your host, Gary Knoll.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. Nice to have you with us today. We have two programs, one now and one in 2 hours. I'd like to thank all of you for listening and sharing the insights and information from my guests and people who appear on this program. I was just told this morning that our audience has almost doubled in the last 6 months. And I won't go over the numbers because they almost seem unbelievable. But there are numbers there through the stratosphere. So thank you. We'd like to believe that there is a place for people to come to who have independent judgment, who can look at something for what it is and come to a reasonable decision without having to first see that, hear it, and experience it through the filtered eyes of ideologies. Hence, everyone is invited to our table. We exclude no one. Today, a special commentary from Chris Hedges on retribution for world lost in screens from Common Dreams. Then, time permitting, we're going to talk about Waiting for Superman, this new school documentary, which I personally feel is filled with half-truths and massive distortions, and principally is there to serve the interest for privatizing education and market-driven school change. It will not help the students. And I don't believe that bashing the teachers is right, and I will give my own input. Being a teacher, and having been a teacher at many universities and schools, am now, I'll give an insight. Also, one of the reasons people enjoy listening to this program is because we break our program into many different segments. For example, the latest on health and healing, but always from peer-reviewed journals. And then taking on topics you simply won't hear elsewhere. For example, my guest today, Professor Andreas Carrasco, will be talking to us from Buenos Aires, Argentina, on his original research from the Director of Laboratory of Molecular Embryology at the University of Buenos Aires Medical School about how Monsanto's Roundup is a major life-threatening health risk. Now, we are leading the effort worldwide to educate people on the dangers of genetic engineering so that then when we say that Michael Taylor, Blackwater, which is a black op organization that has actually gone out and killed people, they're a really dirty operation, but now they've been hired to attack and discredit, infiltrate, and do whatever they can to any organization out there, any groups, any individuals challenging Monsanto. And yet the major media has just let this die. Where is it that a major for-profit corporation can hire its own private mercenary army to go after its enemies? That's fascism. Peak oil. You've heard us talk about it. You've heard Michael Ruppert talk about it, and especially on his show, now on Sunday nights following mine. Why not peak water? You heard me right. Today, I'll talk about peak water. And also, let's talk about the UN warned of a major new food crisis at a very important meeting in Rome. Well, guess what is the primary reason? Environmental disasters? That's a part. No. Speculative investors. That's why millions of people, tens of millions of people, are going to starve. People on Wall Street. Also, the FDA raids activists, anti-war activists' homes. Is this just a replay of Operation COINTELPRO? And why aren't the left and the major media and the Democrats all over this story? But who was on this story today? Glenn Beck. Isn't it interesting? Probably for very different reasons. But I'm very concerned when they have, the government has the right and its secret agencies to listen in on all of our phone calls, look at all of our emails, even want more power to do that. It was discussed over the weekend. And now are raiding the homes of people who are just activists including those who are environmental activists. Meet Generation Hot, not as in sexy hot, but as in hot hot, heat hot. Who was it today who in an ad was saying there is no global warming? Oh, Rush Limbaugh. Mr. Limbaugh, with all due respect, you are out of the loop of reality, as are your listeners. We will talk about an entire new generation that will never know normal climate. And the China superpower, Caligula's horse. Yes, I'm going to do a little commentary from Alan Grayson on Caligula's horse and making sense out of poverty. So that's just what we're going to touch on today and this afternoon. Coming attractions, upcoming guests will come later. No calls, we have a packed show. Let us begin. It was about 30 years ago that we first heard of this wonderful nutrient called coenzyme Q10, or Q10. And then we heard about green tea. And then we heard about soy and isoflavones. And all this came from one place. It came from Japan. In point of fact, the Japanese are well known and respected for the natural healing ingredients that they have been able to give the world. Now, of course, some of these are also used in China, but it was the Japanese doing the research on them. And the Japanese supplement and functional food industry is really rocking. It's very common for Japanese people to have a whole series of natural elixirs from homegrown ingredients. And they use these on a regular basis. They know different types of mushrooms, like yambushite, which is lion's mane mushroom, which has been studied for improving cognitive impairment. We're clueless about this in the United States. The mushroom has previously been the subject of research looking into its effects on respiratory tissues and tumors and lipid metabolism. That's just one thing that they do, and they do well. They take a look more than any other country in the world of all the things you can grow that are natural that can help you live a longer and healthier life. And then they incorporate that into their daily lives. For example, who knew that the Japanese had over 200 commonly consumed products with theanine, the natural amine that helps you relax and de-stress? But they had it long before anyone else, before we were suggesting you use it to de-stress here in the United States. There's a journal called the Journal of Functional Foods. It's an evidence-based publication, and it takes peer-reviewed literature, and it shows you that they're way ahead of the curve. My suggestion is this. In the next month, when I return to New York for my filming, we're going to begin a new website or a section on my website called Functional Food Research. And every time there's a study anywhere in the world from a qualified institution with good results showing you something you can drink or eat that can make a difference, we will publish the results. So then you'll have one place to go. You'll see the actual study and citation in the institution and where it was published. And this will only be with peer-reviewed literature, by the way. But it's virtually unknown in the mainstream media. I doubt that they even published 2 of 10,000 articles. We will publish all 10,000, but more importantly, I will do a lay interpretation so that whatever the science says, as I do every day on my show, I will reinterpret it in lay language. So coming at you, something new and important, more tools for helping you, we will have our own functional food research page with all the research from every country in the world doing important work on natural things we can take into our system. The latest research, the number of fat people in the United States is increasing. In fact, the wealthiest countries are getting fatter and fatter, and the United States is right in front. 3 out of 4 Americans, that's 3 out of 4, that's an enormous amount of Americans will be overweight in just the next 8 years. And the disease rates and the health care spending that go with being overweight will simply make a system that will bankrupt us. So I'll be starting a whole new effort in about 3 weeks to help people who are overweight, and we're going to do it all together as a part of a new health support group. And by the way, just as an aside, I'm selecting tomorrow a date for our new six-month, twice-a-month mental health support group. I'm just getting all the physicians and psychologists, psychiatrists, and neurologists who are going to be a part of it. And then it'll be for anyone with Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS, multiple sclerosis, memory loss, dementia, depression and anxiety, and chronic insomnia. Things impacting the brain. And the whole theme is that I will be helping people in a lifestyle and behavior modification in effect to repair the brain. And because we will be filming the entire thing, and because everyone must have their medical documentation where they can't get in, so that we, the whole world, will be able to see the changes people are making, we have to bypass medicine, bypass governmental agencies, bypass the American media, and go directly to the world citizens who are suffering to show them here's what's possible. So this is a major effort, but I'm also going to have, as a part of that, people who are chronically overweight. So anyhow, that don't call now. I haven't selected the date, and I'm just later today speaking with the final physicians who will be monitoring this, and but I'll be announcing it tomorrow. A wave of addiction and crime, now they're connecting it, as we've been saying all along, much of this to our medicine cabinet. This is from the New York Times. It says, police departments have collected thousands of handguns through a buyback program in communities throughout the country. Now they want the contents of your medicine cabinet. Opiate painkillers and other prescription drugs, they say, are driving addiction and crime like never before, with addicts singling out the homes of sick or elderly people and posing as potential buyers at open houses just to raid the medicine cabinets. The crimes and the severity of the nation's drug abuse problem have so vexed the authorities, they're calling on citizens to surrender old bottles of potent pills like Vicodin and Percocet and Xanax. And on Saturday, the police will set up drop-off stations at Walmarts in different cities for this, in 4,000 other locations. How about this? How about starting a national program in every city in America to hire therapists, qualified therapists, psychologists, sociologists, behavioralists, counselors, who can help individuals without criminalizing the issue, help them understand why they took the drugs in the first place and what they have to do to get off of them. That would be a meaningful first step. Asking people, especially old people, to turn in their old medicines so their house doesn't get ransacked, they may get hurt, so someone could steal their drugs, is looking at the symptom, not the cause. We need to go to a point where we depoliticize the process. Unfortunately, many of the very same super right Republicans who hate homosexuals and believe that the country should be run by a religious oligarch, and that if you commit any crime, you should burn forever. And if you're a drug addict, you should rot forever, even though more often than not, they're closet homosexuals or, you know, doing a lot of sexual playing, only to be shown as the hypocrites they are. They're clueless. They have resolved no issues. Now, just think of this for a moment. The very people who make the most moralizing statements pull back to neutral and ask, what have they done to make it a better world? I'll show you what they've done to make it a worse world. Not a better one. And finally, I knew this would come, where there is a major movement to get people to stop being in the sun. Instead, they want people to, in effect, have tanning drugs so that they can sell them the tanning drugs. And now they're going to try to make it look like the sun's ultraviolet rays are harmful to the skin and cause skin cancer, and you shouldn't be out in the sun, that all these thousands of people are going to die each year from being exposed to the sun and hence melanoma. Well, they want you to take a drug so you can look as if you have an iced tan. My suggestion is that show the truth about the sun and sunscreens and sun exposure, and show how vitamin D is made in the skin and how that vitamin D, generally about 20,000 units for every half hour you're in the sun, actually enhances our immune system, protects us from disease, helps us with osteoporosis, helps us prevent cancer, helps us turn off inflammation in the brain and other places, and is one of the single most important things we can do to help prevent the flu. And yet, imagine people then being even more terrified to go into the sun, but start taking the drugs. And that's all sponsored by the FDA. I got an email from a person who wants to know more about magnets. My original work, and I published a book on this with over 500 studies cited, and this is when the FDA was saying there's no connection between magnets and anything. Sorry, they're about 3,000 years behind the curve on this one. Magnets used properly, especially what is known as repetitive transcranial magnet stimulation, or TMS, involves inducing electromagnetic fields in the brain, and that can help with depression and especially hard-to-treat patients better than any antidepressant drug. And this is the newest research of the Medical University of South Carolina. Quote, this study should help settle the debate about whether the magnetic therapy works for depression. Yes, it does. But then you could use fixed magnets also, and that would also make a difference. So the very magnets that people have been using throughout the world have been rather remarkable. And all you have to do is just study the science behind magnets and the repolarization of the cell, and you understand why magnets can help relieve pain, take away swelling, reduce inflammation in the joints, and rebalance much of our brain chemistry. I'm Gary Noll, back in a moment. Please stay with us. One good place for all of you who care about looking at issues objectively, in depth, without any political bias, because I have no political allegiance. I have no ideological allegiance. I have no religious allegiance, except to believe and deeply believe in the sanctity of life, the moral compass by which we should live, of being kind, thoughtful, nurturing and giving to others, especially those who have less, and always trying to be the best we can as human beings. We don't need to lie and steal and cheat. Those are not necessary in order to have a quality life. So this is one place where we will share those insights. For those of you who have watched the new documentary, Waiting for Superman, by the producers who did An Inconvenient Truth. And I thought An Inconvenient Truth was a fair documentary. It did not provide all the many solutions, nor did it really nail down the history of funding of lobbyists who control the political process, including showing how when Al Gore was vice president, and he was the person who was defending the administration's position on not signing the Kyoto Agreement, how he and the Clinton administration, for all intents and purposes, were pressured by the oil industry, the coal industry, the nuclear industry, to subsidize them, where the important industries were only given lip service, geothermal, wind, and solar. Those were all that nice stuff was left out of his document. But still, it was, for a lot of people, it was a wake-up call. And that was good, and I support that. This new documentary has to be put in context. It's called Waiting for Superman. It's a Davis Guggenheim's film. I believe that it distorts the truth. What they've tried to do, at least my perception, is they've tried to show that our educational system is failing. And it's failing mainly because we have bad teachers and we have an utterly corrupt teachers' union system in our country. And that if we want to go forward and reform this, that what we need is we need a top-down, test-rewarded system, meaning the higher you test out, the greater your rewards as a student and a teacher. So getting good grades on tests is what causes the system to believe that it has the answer. To me, that is a half-truth. First, we do have some bad teachers, but we have an awful lot of good teachers. We have teachers whose hands are tied. They're tied because everybody thought they knew better about what their children should know. So the curriculum review boards frequently, depending upon the state and depending upon the power of groups, would exclude certain books that should have been included in the curriculum and included others that should not have. I see no reason in the world to include books on the Bible's interpretation of when life began on this planet and that we had dinosaurs and Noah's Ark. It's all stupid. It's nonsensical. But that's what happens when you allow people power over what the information is that a child has to learn. Also, the parents get involved, and all a person has to do is shout now, and a teacher's back off. Or a student can say, I don't like you. I don't like the way you teach. I don't like anything about you. I'm going to report you. And suddenly, you have a rubber room teacher that has been suspended from actually teaching and sits all day in this room being paid full salary and yet is not given a chance to really defend themselves. Also, when I was going to school, we had a different set of priorities. You had to study. There was discipline in the classes. You learned about history and social services and geography. You learned your basics. But you also learned in civics classes and other classes, sociology classes, you learned about the world in which you lived. And I was always encouraged growing up to challenge, and I did. And having that type of democratic ideal that all education should be based upon is that you have to allow a child an opportunity to find a creative and innovative way of expressing themselves and learning from teachers who themselves are innovated, and also we have to get the bureaucracy out of education. I am not supportive of the teachers' unions as it now functions. I'm pro-union. I'm anti how the unions in effect by the politicians that continue to perpetuate the bad type of system that we now have. But equally, I believe that the corporate powerhouses and the ideological opponents of anything that represents a public input, we can do it best. We're corporate America. Let us run the school system, and we will show you perfect kids coming out. They will be thoughtful. We'll have the best teachers working with the best students, and we will have smaller classrooms, and we will have make the community proud of this school. We'll do a charter school. Yeah. What about the other 99% of students and teachers? We have so many kids in school, and we have too many children in a classroom, and the school system is grossly underfunded, and there's mammoth bureaucracy. We have to change the bureaucracy. We have to change the way the school system is set up now. But we've created the problem. Now a person can sit in the audience and watch this, a white, upper-middle-class person from suburbia, and say, thank goodness, you know, the Latino and black kids and the poor white kids in the inner cities and the ghettos are finally going to have the truth told. What is the truth? That we created more segregation in our school system now than we've had in the last 50 years? That's what we have. Do you talk about what happens when you don't have full employment, when you have an unstable economy, when you have militarized the entire school system? What happens when parents are stressed to the max and don't have the money and can't even buy the type of school materials that children need? So, yes, you can look at a Harlem Children's Zone, the model of this, but look at all the millions of dollars from private donations that go into that. I could take any school in the United States, in any ghetto in the United States, and if I had the same amount of money and celebrity input that that one school has, I could make it the model of all education. And where should we care about where we stand in relationship to science or math of the Japanese and the Indians? Are they competitors? Are we telling a student today that you better be careful because if you don't do better, then the Japanese, the Chinese, the Koreans, and the Indians are all going to take your jobs. There's a shortage of jobs, and you're going to be too stupid to get out of the system with any grades? Or do we do what we do now? We take the individual and give them private tutors. We give them all forms of textbooks that show them how to study for an exam. And so therefore they pass the exams, they get better grades, and then they are able to get into schools that are thought to be better schools. They get out of those schools and with better grades, and now they're revered, they're sought after. And so those are the ones who go to work in Washington, in the White House, in Congress, and or the lobbying groups. So they're the ones who go to Wall Street. They're the ones who go to the think tanks and the foundations. Would you stop for a moment? Since when have either the Democrats, Republicans, all of these best and brightest, since when have they made it a better world? Do they support organic? No, genetically engineered. Do they support a natural way of looking at the prevention of disease? No. Don't care about the disease, just help people with some medication when they're finally sick. Do they care about really reforming the political process and getting rid of all finances by all individuals so that it's all publicly funded so a baker, a police officer, a firefighter could run for office? No. They want it so they and they alone can get elected. So these are the people who graduated, the best and the brightest in the best and brightest schools. And just remember who caused the war in Iraq and Afghanistan. Ivy League graduates all. The neocons and the Blue Dog Democrats, those are Democrats in drag. Those are your Republican Democrats. Bill Clinton is one. Barack Obama is a superstar. These are the people who are causing all the trouble in the world. Yet, show me the kids from the inner city. Show me the kids in the teachers who are working the best they can in a system that deprives them of so much, that alienates them, that segregates them. You have more segregation now in American schools than you did since Brown versus Board of Education 1954. Why don't we ever discuss that? Where African American and Latino students are considered the problematic students, the ones more likely to cause the crime. Then it becomes self-fulfilling. We should be having, in every city in the United States, we should have an opportunity for all the people to learn. And where did Obama's kids attend? Did they attend one of these inner city environments? No. University of Chicago lab schools, where they had tiny little classes, the teachers were considered good, but what did they learn? Here's the issue. If all you can do is teach a kid how to take a test, then you've prepared that child for nothing in the world of the future. You don't allow them to question the curriculum. They must. How does a student learn to make it a better world and to better understand the world they live in? We need to build learning communities in every town in America. Then we need to engage in the learning experience with the student. And that way we're just not graduating a whole group of cloned, obedient cultist. I don't see any of the people projecting a transformative mindset graduating from these elite schools. So, filmmakers, you can make films, but the next time you make a film like this, put on the outside that it's a propaganda piece, not an authentic documentary. I'm Gary Knoll, back in a moment with a short commentary, then my guest. Please stay with us.
I only meant to love you. Didn't you know it, baby? Didn't you know it? Why couldn't you be content with the love I gave? Oh, yeah. I gave you my heart, but you wanted my mind. Oh, yeah. Your love scared me to death, girl. Oh, it's a choking kind. That's all it is. You can kill a man.
For all of you throughout the world, I welcome you. We're going to be going to Argentina in a moment, and to London, where my two guests, Claire Robinson and Professor Andreas Carrasco, are standing by. But first, I believe a very important commentary, and one that hopefully individuals will be able to understand its meaning. If you listened to my commentary last night on my evening show, you will understand my motivation. Nemesis was the Greek goddess of retribution. She exacted divine punishment on arrogant mortals who believed that they could defy the gods, turn themselves into objects of worship, and build ruthless systems of power to control the world around them. The price of such hubris was always death. Nemesis, related to the Greek word nemean, means to give what is due. Our nemesis fast approaches. We will get what we are due. The staggering myopia of our corrupt political and economic elite, which plunder the nation's wealth for financial speculation and endless war, the mass retreat of citizens into virtual hallucinations, the collapsing edifices around us, which include the ecosystem that sustains life, are ignored by a giddy self-worship. We stare into electronic screens just as narcissist, bespotted with his own reflection, stared into a pool of water until he wasted away and died. We believe that because we have the capacity to wage war, we have the right to wage war. We believe that money, rather than manufactured products and goods, is real. We believe in the myth of inevitable human moral and material progress. We believe that no matter how much damage we do to the earth or our society, science and technology will save us. And as temperatures on the planet steadily rise, as droughts devastate cropland, as the bleaching of coral reefs threatens to wipe out 25% of all marine species, as countries such as Pakistan and Bangladesh succumb to severe flooding, as we poison our food and air and water, as we refuse to confront our addiction to fossil fuels and coal, as we dismantle our manufacturing base and plunge tens of millions of Americans into a permanent and desperate underclass, we flick on a screen and are entranced. We confuse the electronic image, a reflection back to us of ourselves, with the divine. We gawk at reality television, which of course is contrived reality, reveling in being the viewer and the viewed. True reality is obliterated from our consciousness. It is the electronic image that informs and defines us. It is the image that gives us our identity. It is the image that tells us what is attainable in the vast cult of the self, what we should desire, what we should seek to become, and who we are. It is the image that tricks us into thinking we have become powerful, as the popularity of video games built around the themes of violence more illustrates, while we have become enslaved and impoverished by the corporate state. The electronic image leads us back to the worship of ourselves. It is idolatry. Reality is replaced with electronic mechanisms for preening self-presentation, the core of social networking sites such as Facebook, and the illusion of self-fulfillment and self-empowerment. And in a world unmoored from the real, from human limitations and human potentials, we inevitably embrace superstition and magic. This is what the worship of images is about. We retreat into a dark and irrational fear born out of a cavernous ignorance of the real. We enter an age of technological barbarism. To those entranced by images, the world is a vast stage on which they are called to enact their dreams. It is a world of constant action, stimulation, and personal advancement. It is a world of thrills and monetary ecstasy. It is a world of ceaseless movement. It makes a fetish of competition. It is a world of where commercial products and electronic images serve as pseudotherapy that caters to feelings of alienation, inadequacy, and powerlessness. We may be locked in dead-end jobs, have no meaningful relationships, and be confused about our identities, but we can blast our way to power holding a little control panel while looking for hours at a screen. We can ridicule the poor and the ignorant and the weak all day long on trash talk shows and reality television shows. We are skillfully made to feel that we have a personal relationship, a false communion with the famous. Look at the outpouring of grief at the death of Princess Diana or Michael Jackson. We have never met those we adore. We only look at the manufactured image. They appear to us on screens. They are not, at least to us, real people, and yet we worship and seek to emulate them. In this state of cultural illusion, any description of actual reality, because it does not consist of the happy talk that pollutes the airwaves from national public radio to the supercilious Oprah, is dismissed as negative or pessimistic. The beleaguered Jeremiahs who momentarily stumble into our consciousness and in the desperate frenzy seek to warn us of our impending self-destruction are derided because they do not lay out easy formulas that permit us to drift back into fantasy. We tell ourselves that they are overreacting. If reality is a bummer, and if there are no easy solutions, we simply don't want to hear about it. The facts of economic and environmental collapse, now incontrovertible, cannot be discussed unless they are turned into a joking banter come accompanied by a neat, pleasing solution, the kind we are fed at the conclusion of the movies, electronic games, talk shows, and sitcoms, the kind that dulls our mind into a passive and empty receptacle. We have been conditioned by electronic hallucinations to expect happy talk, and we demand it. We confuse this happy talk with hope. But hope is not about a belief in progress. Hope is about protecting simple human decency and demanding justice. Hope is the belief, not necessarily grounded in the tangible, that those whose greed, stupidity, and complacency have allowed us to be driven over a cliff shall one day be brought down. Hope is about existing in a perpetual state of rebellion, a constant antagonism to all centers of power. The great moral voices such as George Orwell or Albert Camus, being perhaps two of the finest examples, describe in moving detail the human suffering we ignore or excuse. They understand that the greatest instrument for moral good is the imagination, the ability to perceive the pain and suffering of another, to feel, as King Lear says, what wretches feel, is a more powerful social corrective than the shelves of turgid religious and philosophical treatise on human will. Those who change the world for the better, who offer us hope, have the capacity to make a step outside of ourselves and feel empathy. A print-based culture, as writer Neil Postman pointed out, demands rationality. The sequential, proportional character of the written word fosters what Walter Ong calls the analytic magnet of knowledge. But our brave new world of images dispenses with these attributes because the images do not require them to be understood. Communication in the image-based culture is not about knowledge. It is about the corporate manipulation of emotions, something logic, order, nuance, and context protect us against. Thinking, in short, is the new forbidden. Entertainment and spectacle have become the aim of all human endeavors, including politics, which is how Stephen Colbert, playing his television character, came to be permitted to testify before the House Judiciary Committee. Campaigns are built around the manufactured personal narratives of candidates who function as political celebrities rather than policies or ideas. News reports become soap operas and many dramas revolving around the latest celebrity scandal. College and universities, which view students as customers and suck obscene tuition payments and loans out of them with the tantalizing promise of high-paying corporate jobs, have transformed themselves into resorts and theme parks. In this new system of education, almost no one fails. Students become brothers or sisters to the tribal embrace, fraternities or sororities all give one big hug. School spirit and school branding is paramount. campus security keeps these isolated enclaves of privilege secure. And 90,000-seat football stadiums, along with their millionaire coaches, dominate the campus. It is moral leprosy. The role of knowledge and art, as the ancient Greeks understood, is to create ecstasis, which means standing outside oneself to give our individual life and struggle meaning and perspective. The role of art and scholarship is to transform us as individuals, not entertain us as a group. It is to nurture this capacity for understanding and empathy. Art and scholarship allow us to see the underlying structures and assumptions used to manipulate and control us. And this is why art, like intellectual endeavor, is feared by the corporate elite as subversive. This is why corporations have used their money to deform universities into vocational schools that spit out blinkered and illiterate system managers. This is why the humanities are withering away. And in conclusion, the vast stage of entertainment that envelops our culture is intended to impart the opposite of ecstasis. Mass entertainment plays to the basest and crudest instincts of the crowd. It conditions us to have the same aspirations and desires. It forces us to speak in the same dead cliches and slogan. It homogenizes human experience. It wallows in a cloying nostalgia and sentimentality that fosters historical amnesia. It turns the other into a cartoon or a stereotype. It prohibits empathy because it prohibits understanding. It denies human singularity and uniqueness. It assures us that we all have within us the ability, talent, and luck to become famous and rich. It forms us into a lowing and compliant herd. We have been conditioned to believe, defying all the great moral and philosophical writers from Socrates to Orwell, that the aim of life is not to understand it, but to be entertained by it. If we do not shake ourselves awake from this electronic hallucination and defy the elites, we are ruining the country and trashing the planet. We will experience the awful and deadly retribution of the gods. And that brings us up to my guest. And a special thanks to Chris Hedges. My guest, as I mentioned earlier in the program, are online right now. Let's say hello from Buenos Aires, Argentina, Professor Andre Carcesco. Nice to have you with us today, sir.
Hi, how are you?
And also from England, Claire Robinson. Claire is a longtime activist on genetically modified organisms and toxicological issues. She is the senior editor of GM Watch in the UK, an independent nonprofit organization founded in 1998 with a mission to counter the corporate power and propaganda of the big agri and biotech industries. And she will be a regular monthly contributor on the Progressive Radio Network, bringing us the latest on genetically modified crops and Monsanto and other things. Nice to have you with us today, Claire.
Hi, thank you.
Claire, we're going to begin with you. Tell us about why we should be concerned at this moment about genetically engineered food and Monsanto and DuPont and others, and this administration and Congress and the FDA and the USDA all backing the idea that it's better living through genetically modified crops and we shouldn't be critical of it.
Well, that's a very big question. It would take a very, very long time to answer that question in full. But basically, GM crops were introduced on world markets back in the 1990s with absolutely minimal safety tests. It was basically a political decision. The US FDA, Food and Drug Administration, just waved these crops through because they were ordered to foster the biotechnology industry by the then Bush administration. This was very much a political decision, and the FDA did not then and does not now require proper testing on GM crops. They allow the companies to submit the data on which the approvals process is based. The companies decide which data they want to submit. The FDA basically just writes the company, usually it's Monsanto because they dominate the GM crop market. The FDA then writes the company a letter saying, we understand that Monsanto claims on the basis of data it has submitted to the FDA that this food is safe for human consumption. And that is basically the so-called rigorous approvals process that is put in place in America. The rest of the country, the rest of the world has really followed the FDA in this very inadequate method of approving GM foods for consumption. And very often, no independent research has been done on these crops and these foods. Since the FDA passed the first GM foods in the 1990s, there have, however, been a number of independent studies by scientists which have shown dangers from GM foods and, more recently, dangers from the glyphosate herbicide, which is better known to most of us as Roundup, which is sprayed on the most common GM crop, which is GM Roundup Ready soy, or soy, as I think you call it in America. And Professor Carrasco, who is one of the guests on the program today, is going to be talking about his research showing that glyphosate or Roundup is actually an extremely dangerous substance. It is promoted by Monsanto and the other companies that make this herbicide as an essentially safe and benign substance that you can spray around your garden or on your fields if you're a farmer. It's safe to use around children and pets, this is what they say. The research says no, it is not safe. Carrasco's research is just the latest in a series of studies which show that this is a very dangerous substance. And there are acres of genetically modified soy in America, North America, South America, which have been genetically engineered to tolerate this herbicide, which means basically that farmers can just spray it on liberally onto the crop. It kills the weeds but allows the crop to grow on because of this genetic modification that allows the soya to resist the herbicide. So that's what we're talking about today.
All right. Then also talk about what research you're aware of concerning the Roundup that has not been made public, and the politics of you being able to talk about it in England and other countries, but we're not able to talk about it in the United States.
Well, this is a very interesting subject. The overall censorship of scientific findings. In fact, the science is there for people who have the time and the energy to look for it. Just as an example, Professor Carrasco's study on glyphosate, he actually released his findings way back in 2009 in Argentina because he said that he felt that the findings were so important to public health that he shouldn't wait for them to be published in a scientific journal. Incidentally, they have been published since then, in August 2010, but at the time they were not published. And what happened actually to Professor Carrasco's study was very interesting because I understand that there was very little coverage in his home country, Argentina, which has based its entire economy on genetically modified soy sprayed with glyphosate. So obviously the government in Argentina has a very big interest in protecting the interests of this industry. However, what has happened to this research is that Professor Carrasco published it and it basically dropped into a black hole. It certainly has not been reported in the mainstream media in England or in Europe. And we at GM Watch are trying somewhat to redress this balance by putting out press releases to the media and talking about this research on shows such as this. But it is really an uphill battle. It seems that nobody really wants to report this story. I know that they are all reading our press releases. That's obvious from the feedback that I'm getting. But the stories just don't seem to get into the mainstream media.
Finally, before we go over to Professor Carrasco, what are your thoughts when it was just revealed that Monsanto had hired Blackwater, a mercenary group that has killed people, that has black op operations, that works secretly, that is a part of these different campaigns of extermination in Iraq and Afghanistan and elsewhere. And now they are targeting the infiltration and dissemination of information on any individual or groups that challenges Monsanto and genetic engineering.
Yes, this was it was a horrifying story. I can't pretend that I'm entirely surprised. Monsanto has a very long history of dirty tricks employed against its enemies who interfere with its vested interests. In particular, a story that we broke several years ago was how some scientists, in fact, at UC Berkeley in America, had reported the GM contamination of indigenous Mexican maize varieties. Now, this was a major story. They published their findings in a scientific journal. It was a peer-reviewed study, so all very respectable from that point of view. But what happened when these scientists published their research was that there was a very, very aggressive, targeted campaign against those scientists in an attempt to discredit them. GM Watch did a bit of investigation into this, and we eventually traced this smear campaign against the scientists to a public relations group called the Bibbings Group, and they, of course, were contracted by Monsanto to manage their public relations. We did manage to get that story in the mainstream press in England, but I am concerned by the fact that, you know, we break these stories and they do appear in the media from time to time, but at no point do governments actually seem to say, well, maybe we should stop believing people like Monsanto when they say that GM crops are going to be the salvation of the world, that they solve all problems. You know, at what point do we stop believing these people? This is the company that brought us Agent Orange and insisted that, you know, no collateral damage would occur and everything would be fine. And they're still denying the problems that were caused in Vietnam from Agent Orange. They're also the company that polluted the town of Anniston in America with PCBs. And that has been a terrible scandal. So why should we believe them anymore?
And they were found in criminal negligence on that and had to pay a $700 million fine.
Yes.
Let's now go over and say hello again to Professor Andreas Carrasco. He is the director of the Laboratory of Molecular Embryology at the University of Buenos Aires Medical School in Argentina. He is also the lead researcher at Argentina's National Council of Scientific and Technical Research. Welcome again to our show, sir.
Hi. Hello.
I
barely can listen. If you can increase the volume of return, it would be nice for me.
Okay, I just pushed my mic as far as I can,
and
my studio in New York is doing the same.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors in Argentina and Paraguay have been witnessing a rapid rise in serious health effects among residents near large, big agri-soy farms using glyphosate. And
yeah.
Monsanto's Roundup, these include high rates of birth defects, stillbirths, miscarriages, infertility problems, a variety of cancers. Could you go through this with us and show us your concern and what you've been able to find about the safety of these genetically modified crops?
Could you tell me again, because I barely can listen to you. It's very difficult.
Could you tell us what problems do you have with Monsanto's crops? We're going to say goodbye to our WMYE audience. You can continue listening to this program.
Well,
on the Radio Network.
I mean, I personally didn't have contact with Monsanto. What I have is our problem with some of the chambers that represent the agrochemical industry here, but Monsanto, directly with Monsanto, I didn't have any contact. But of course, I have problems with some of the groups that manage the distribution of agrochemicals in Argentina, and still they are doing this kind of things. making pressure or some kind of statements in newspaper, etc., etc.
What is your own research? Why? What is your problem that you have with genetically engineered seed or the chemicals used on the seed?
Well, you mean what is the research that we did?
Yes.
Yeah. Well, we just tried to prove or to test the glyphosate, the basis herbicide, in embryos, in frog embryos and chicken embryos. And that's not only we check the herbicide itself, the commercial herbicide, we also check the pure molecule, I mean the glyphosate itself as an active component in embryos. And we showed that in very little amounts, and very diluted and little amounts, they produce malformations during the very early stage of development. And this probably is due to the fact that the glyphosate interfere in vitamin A metabolism and affecting a substance called retinoic acid. And the increasing of retinoic acid seems to be one of the reasons why we get these malformations in these animal models.
All right.
Okay.
I thank you. And final comments, Claire Robinson, on what you believe we should be doing in the United States and around the world. We have an international audience listening concerning the mainstream media supporting genetically engineered, the lobbyists they have on their side, the political system protecting them, and especially the President of the United States, who actually appointed Michael Taylor to oversee food safety at the very time that they're passing food safety laws that would give genetically engineered foods the primary driver's seat in the food of the future.
Yes. Can I just go very briefly back to Professor Carrasco's findings, because these are really major findings and the world should sit up and notice this. What Professor Carrasco found was that glyphosate-based Roundup herbicide causes malformations in frog and chicken embryos in doses very much lower than those used in agricultural spraying. And that means in doses lower than you or I would use if we were using Roundup in our garden. It is promoted for that purpose. So these are extremely low dilutions that Professor Carrasco found malformations in. And he was led to do this research by many, many reports from GM soy growing areas in Argentina, which showed human birth defects in very high rates, escalating rates, just since the introduction of GM soy. GM soy is a crop which is designed to allow the huge use of glyphosate. 75% of all the world's GM crops are GM soy. So this is a very, very serious part of the GM industry. It is the major crop that they're promoting and selling. They promote GM crops as somehow reducing pesticides and having potential to feed the world. This is nonsense. We're showing that these findings of Professor Carrasco and other scientists undoubtedly show that GM soy has led to huge increases in the use of Roundup glyphosate herbicide, and also increases in the uses of other herbicides, because what is happening increasingly is that nature is throwing up weeds that are resistant to glyphosate herbicide. So farmers are having to turn to increasingly toxic old herbicides in order to control these so-called super weeds. So this is fundamentally unsustainable. The only suggestion that the GM companies are coming up with in response to these so-called Roundup resistant super weeds is more and toxic chemicals. So this is really unsustainable. What I would like governments to do is to face up to the independent research on glyphosate and GM crops. There are research studies which show ill health effects in experimental animals after they've been fed GM crops. Now, time and time again, we hear claims in the media that there are no health effects from GM crops, or this hasn't been proven, or we don't know. This actually is not true. We have brought out on our website, we're actually promoting a paper, scientific paper, which is co-authored by 9 international scientists. Professor Carrasco is one of these scientists, and it collects together masses and masses of studies, over 100 peer-reviewed studies, which show that GM soy and the glyphosate herbicide it is sprayed with are absolutely not safe and not sustainable. And the report is called GM Soy Sustainable Responsible? And it's available on the GM Watch website. In future, it will be available elsewhere as well. It's been released to the press in many countries. It will be translated into 5 different languages. One of the problems with the GM crop issue is the language barrier. An awful lot of the bad things that happen with GM crops happen in South America, as Professor Carrasco can confirm. And in Europe, on the whole, we do not get to hear about those problems. Similarly, American farmers are having huge problems with Roundup-resistant superweeds. But again, in Europe, we don't get to hear about that. You know, the newspapers on the whole do not report it. This paper collects together all the problems relating to GM soy and glyphosate Roundup, and presents them in one go. So I would invite people to go to our website, www.gmwatch.org, download the report, distribute it to your friends, tell your government to stop supporting this ridiculously unsustainable industry that really doesn't bring benefits to anybody. It's not going to feed the world. GM crops yield less than their non-GM counterparts. So how are these crops going to save anybody? They're not.
Okay. Claire Robinson, we look forward to having you on the Progressive Radio Network each month for an update on genetic engineering around the world and all the different studies and movements, so that people realize that we are a large and expanding group of individuals concerned about our food supply. Thank you very much. And also, I want
to thank,
though we couldn't hear Professor Andreas Carrasco very well, thank you very much, sir, for all the good work you're doing. We look forward to posting your articles on our website.
Thank you very much,
We're out of time. Just a quick preview of some of the other programs. In 2 hours from now, I'll be back with Eric Weiner. We had such a positive response to this investigative journalist covering the economic and business world out there, showing us the hidden shadow markets and how it dominates the world. We're going to have him back as a guest at 3 o'clock. And also later this week, we're going to take an in-depth look at fracking, high fracking areas of Pennsylvania, and look at the terrible health consequences of this dirty practice by Dr. Pedris, a physician who lives in that high fracking area. By the way, one of the things the FBI raids on activist homes was the people who were involved in anti-gas fracking drilling were also targeted. So I'll deal with that. The FBI raids activist homes and are literally the same corrupt organization that was responsible for Operation COINTELPRO. They're just continuing their fascist policies. And then later in the week, you'll really find David DeGraw interesting. I'm going to devote a whole hour on the economic and political banking cartels and leading us to a larger global catastrophic-based form of economic imperialism. And who are these people? How are they doing it? How are they getting wealthier? And the studies just came out Friday showing that the wealthiest got a lot wealthier and everyone else got poorer. How do they do that? So we're going to talk about all that on Friday of this week. A lot to discuss this week, all important. Thank you for listening. I'm Gary Knoll, back in 2 hours. Now stay tuned for Dr. Z and the Natural Nurse.
The Gary Knoll Show is produced in our New York City studios. The producer is Richard Gale. The engineer is Matt Bogart. All shows are archived by Joe Kemp. Our chief archivist is Sharon Pride. And the program director is Carol Lee. It only comes out when